Okay, Nick, how you doing?
Doing okay. Just a quiet night in Britain. So,
Yo,
what is it? It's just mid morning for you. Noon?
This is just afternoon for us. The UK do you live exactly?
Oh, right in the middle of London. I'm in Battersea.
Oh, you live in London?
Just south of the river.
Great.
I'm on the less classy side of the river. I'm where you can still find the occasional real person who isn't running a bank.
Cool, right on. I was glad to get your email forwarded from Rick because, I'm a super hardcore Nirvana fan and have been for my entire life. And, it's just not that often that I get to connect with other people that are of the same mind. And I thought first, I was just curious, how did you get into the band? When did that happen for you?
I guess it's the same as you. I mean, I was sort of 13 or something at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a school trip and some guy handed me a cassette tape with Nevermind recorded on one side and Bleach on the other. And it just made sense immediately. I guess maybe there's an... I always wonder about that, whether there's an age where music has an impact and where it's easy to latch onto a sound and realize that it matters. So I caught that, and then a year later, the news bulletin comes on, which is Cobain's death. I mean, I probably still remember the news bulletin word for word today. Right.
Were you at that point, even in your teen years, like, did you kind of know this would be a band that you would probably be into for the rest of your life? Did you think it that way, or did you take a break and then get back into it as an adult? How did that work for you?
I think at age 13, the idea of being a 35 is so many light years away. I don't think I even imagined that 35 existed.
Right.
That's just what happened to old people and other people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's a curious one. But it's not. It led me to other places. I drew a grid map of music.
Mm-hmm.
It would go from Nirvana through Sonic Youth, through Swans, and just keep expanding. So I've gone to other places ever since, but the nice thing is there's always been, every couple of years, a Nirvana release that was worth taking a look at, or a bootleg I could come back to. There's always been something to bring me back to Nirvana. I guess it's like an old friend. You don't necessarily connect with them every day.
Yeah. Yeah, I
feel see them again. It just fixes. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember Nirvana really got me into punk rock, and it was reading Michael Azarod's book Come As You Are when I was a kid, and that getting me into Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and the Melvins and so forth and so forth, and it just kind of branches out from there. And
exactly the experience. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we're probably only a couple of years apart. I'm 32. I'm guessing you're in your mid-30s.
That's it, yeah, only a touch older. The last years I've spent with so many Nirvana fans, and I've always enjoyed asking them, look, what was your moment, that exact question? And it always comes back to some moment in their mid-teens where some people are much younger than you and I,
mm-hmm.
and yet they still have that moment somewhere around 13, 14, 15.
Yeah.
It was 10 where suddenly it just caught them.
I wonder sometimes, what do you think it is about the band? Because it's hard for people like us to say since we've been into it for a long time, but, there are, teenagers, young teens now that still connect with it. Like, I see kids wearing T-shirts, and I know the records still sell, having worked at a record store for years. And, what do you think it is?
It was a few weeks ago. I think Nevermind was back in the charts again. I think the Montage of Heck film pushed the album back into the Billboard charts. And that's an amazing idea that a 20-year-old record just goes straight back in like that.
Right.
Lucky for that. One of the first quotes I used in the book was a guy called Victor Poison Tet, who was from a band in New York. And he gave this quote I loved, which was something about... why should we care about Kurt Cobain? Because he'll never let us down. He'll never make a song called Smells Like the Interior of a New Lexus. He'll never suffer a wardrobe malfunction in the middle of the Super Bowl. And it was a great thought that it's sad to think of it that way, but dying at your peak like that, when you've released three albums, all of which are at extremely high quality when you've never left that brief bubble where you are totally the zeitgeist, when you are that moment. If you never leave that, it's very hard to disappoint people.
It's true.
There'll never be a leftover of the kind of quality of, you know you're right, or the Unplugged release, but it almost doesn't matter anymore. It's always nice to see these little shreds come up and these things that make you think that there was the potential for more, that there could have been yet more great albums.
Right. And you know what's interesting to me is that, all the 90s alternative explosion that came with the mainstream after Nirvana got so popular, I mean, there have been plenty of other bands that have enjoyed sustained success, but they don't necessarily inspire anyone that's younger. You know, like, say, Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam's basically a classic rock band for people that never grew out of the 90s, you know what I mean? And yet Nirvana continues to be relevant to younger kids that go on to start bands. I mean, nobody's starting a band that's 18 being like, yeah, like Pearl Jam, I'm so into it. Like, nobody does that. But
bingo.
You know what
it's
I mean?
Business. Yeah, I always feel sorry for the guys. Sorry that Pearl Jam have... People forget Pearl Jam was so massive. I mean, I remember at school that whether you listened to Nirvana or Pearl Jam made a difference in terms of which group of people you hung out with. It was totally a part of that kind of social climate of being a teenager, and yet that's almost unnoticed today. But I guess that's the harm of staying alive and keeping on going, is that at some point the people who just want you to stay the same are disappointed because you change, whilst the people who would rather listen to a band that does something different have already discounted you because they think you're just about one thing. So watching a band like the Foo Fighters go from their early releases, which have such momentum, they're still a huge phenomenon. They still obviously live very in a very comfy fashion, but...
Oh, yeah, they're just so lame. They're just so incredibly lame. Yeah. It's very interesting.
People live long enough to become lame.
I know. It's like, it's not their fault in a way, but it's still like, it kind of makes Nirvana look a whole lot better when you look at it in that light. And, I was looking at, I was reading through your blog, of course, which I wasn't familiar with your blog, and it's so exhaustive. It's great. Like, I used to be really into Live Nirvana, and all those sites, and this is just a great website. And then, of course, your book, I Found My Friends, is, I can't wait to read it. It's super exhaustive, and I love the Q&A format. Like, Live from New York is one of my favorites, the Saturday Night Live oral history, same kind of thing. When did you decide to start, writing in great volume about the band? I mean, you really have put a lot of words on paper, so to speak.
I guess you asked earlier whether I was surprised, about me still being a fan after all these years, but I think it surprises me that I started to write a book about Nirvana in 2012 just as a kind of challenge to myself, just as a hobby exercise. The idea that I'm still writing about Nirvana in 2015 surprises me as well. So I guess where I got started is, I've got a shelf load of Nirvana books. I mean, I think I've got 40 books here.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at that, and there was a publisher doing something very rare and letting anyone send in a proposal. So I did a small volume on Incesticide, just self-published that year. But I remember seeing a contest, and we're looking at the shelf of books and thinking, with no disrespect to anyone, I'm sure I could do better than half of these books.
Yeah.
I'm sure I could come up with something that was an original contribution that showed the kind of passion of a true fan, rather than just someone who writes about Nirvana because they were big and they might sell some copies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I started. I mean, the blog became the next fixation, where I thought I was done. I thought I was empty, but I kept finding these leftover thoughts, these things I wanted to speak about. And that in turn led into this next exercise of pure fixation and fight insanity, where I was blogging one day about all the bands Nirvana played with over the years, how many bands did they play with, who did they play with the most, how many bands played with them in multiple years, all that kind of thing. And I just kept thinking, who are these bands? That's all
right.
I wondered.
Right.
Who is, you know, who are Witchy Boo? Who are the Swaziland White Band? Who was in Machine? And I thought there were so many people out there, so many people who just never had a chance to tell their part of this experience.
Right.
There's all these books, there's all these magazine articles where you see the same superstars, the same people tell the same stories over and over again. I think the story is pretty well established, but I was pretty sure that there were people out there who hadn't told it their way.
Yeah.
So I just started and gradually kept discovering that people were so open to talking about that time in their life, about what they did musically and creatively, that I enjoyed pursuing it. It was lovely to come home from work, get myself together, and about 9 p.m. each night, sit down, start work, finished about 1, 2 a.m., go to bed, get up at 7 a.m., do it again. It was something nice to come home to despite the exhaustion.
Yeah.
Eventually,
and, you know,
I think I owed people.
It's so cool, the folks you track down. I mean, I'm looking at the inside look on Amazon right now, for example, and here's a, you know, quote from Mike Moraski from Steel Pole Bathtub. I mean, like,
yeah.
Who's talking to Mike Moraski about Nirvana? You know, like, that's really cool. Did you have a hard time tracking people down? I mean, how did you go about finding everyone?
As the momentum builds, it gets easier. But when you start, it literally was just a case of sitting down, getting Google up, and just piling in band names, combinations of people's names in the band, and just seeing what popped up. And eventually you'd find a still active band that someone was a member of now, or you'd find a Facebook page that linked to them. You'd be able to see maybe an old band photo, and you went, yep, this is the guy. Or
mm-hmm.
there'd be an article where someone was interviewed, and you'd go, right, that's what they're doing now. It was just a case of being very polite,
right,
very respectful. There was one person, a lady from, which band? There was a lady who's in a band called Caustic Soda, who were a Portland punk band, and she works at a vet's now. She's a veterinary surgeon. And I ended up finding her via her workplace. And to me, that felt like a line I was a bit unsure crossing, but I just wrote a very polite email. And she came back saying that she was the talk of the office that day, that everyone wanted to know about this band she'd been in and how she'd played with Nirvana back in the day. she seemed more amused, which was a real relief. I think I did tell her that that was a relief.
That's really cool. I mean, did you have some favorites in particular of these interviews that maybe you didn't even expect to be great interviews? Like who was the most fun to speak with?
The most fun to speak with, I think, was Chris Kirkwood from Meat Puppets. There wasn't that much I could use from the guy, I'd have to admit, because he has a very free-form way of speaking where I could just give him a thought or give him sometimes even an actual question, if it actually even fitted, and he would just run with it for 10, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The transcript, I think, was something like 12 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I doubt I could use more than a couple of hundred words, but he was such an open and warm presence and gave such a sense of the life that
right.
he handedly had led. He was great fun. In terms of people who were the conversations that are special to me, I visited two bands in Tacoma up in the far northwest, and I ended up meeting a guy called John Perky, who was in a band called Machine and was quite a close friend of Kurt Cobain's, who actually showed me he's got a box containing all the cassettes that Cobain used to record for him, and a copy of Nirvana's first single with a big note on the front from Kurt saying, oh, here's our first
wow.
single, it's not even our song, that kind of thing. He was great. And then once he'd kind of vetted me, he invited around the old drummer from Machine, a guy called Ryan, who, again, was an absolute pleasure. They then got their friends from Yellow Snow, who are another one of those very early bands that Nirvana played with.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of this day in Tacoma, I was sitting in a basement with these guys in their present band performing as I just sat in the corner. And then we all went and sat in their garage on sofas, and they told stories about what it was like to play at the Community World Theatre, what it was like being essentially a teenage band in 1987 in the back end of nowhere,
right?
What it was like watching this band who suddenly went on to become something significant. That was really intriguing to speak to people who, you know, just like you and I, you know, they're just guys who loved music when they were young, and by sheer chance, some friend of theirs goes on to do something incredible. That was brilliant.
Yeah, and I mean, what a neat experience, not just to be discussing, you know, hardcore Nirvana stuff, but like learning all these little things about tiny little scenes here and there and all over the United States and different parts of, it's just, I don't know, I think that's a great musical little journey that you kind of took yourself on.
The sheer quantity of what was going on at the time, I mean, that was incredible for me to realize that someone was going to come through, that there was so much coming up and so many bands playing so many varieties of punk-inspired, rock-inspired music, that something had to happen. And that really struck home, just how much was going on. And also how many of the bands know each other. That was brilliant, how you'd constantly talk to someone who knew someone you had just spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
That was lovely. And often that it provoked former band members or people who hadn't spoken in a few years to get in touch with each other or say something. It sounds mushy, but it's kind of nice to do something as individual and private as sit and write in.
Mm-hmm.
By doing so, to speak to so many people, to make connections with so many people, and in turn to hear back from people that you've had some sort of positive effect. I ended up speaking to a record label called Soul Jazz Records, who are really good for kind of archive releases. And so many people had sent me music from that era. And I kept thinking, I mean, I've never heard these guys. Wow, this is great. But I ended up being able to persuade the record label to put together an archive release of lost music from the Northwest. From that,
yes. Soul Jazz is a UK label, right?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah,
It did make it to the US. It was called No Seattle.
Oh, right.
That was a good big one. It was a nice little sidebar to just put a little bit of that music back into the world.
Right.
Every band on the, you know, there's a band that Jack and Dino was in. There's a band that Joe Channing was in, Aaron Burkhart, Dave Foster. So three of them are as drummers, one of the big producers. It was a fun experience for Nirvana obsessives.
That's fabulous. And you know, here in Chico, the Nirvana show is kind of this legendary thing. You know, there's people that are in town still that were there. I know a guy that was playing in one of the opening bands. But, you know, the venue is long since closed. It's currently a guitar shop. There's no live recording of it, and it's just this totally rumored little event. And I know there's other places like Chico where there's not a recording that's around. Not a lot of them, but they're out there. And it's just kind of one of these, like, hallowed shows. Have you come across any recordings in your research that you kind of unearthed for the first time as far as live shows go?
It was surprising how little that popped up. There's a Nirvana community called Live Nirvana who do an amazing job of surfacing lost recordings. They're incredible.
Yeah. I love that site.
When I went back to the bands, it was surprising how few of the musicians had done that kind of thing. So there was the occasional interview that they managed to pop up, people who put me onto friends of theirs who had something. But it was kind of sad how, at this far removed, there's still stuff that shows up. But there was nothing that I came up with, which was sad. There's still this stubborn third of Nirvana shows where there's still no record and where you can't help but wonder what went on.
Right.
What you said about closed venues is good as well, that I went for this week's trip around the northwest of America, you know, my first time on the West Coast, and of course, I did Nirvana days. I did go around and photograph all these places Nirvana played. And, of course, they're kind of nothing. That's the kind of brilliant thing. If you can imagine taking a holiday to the other side of the world in order to look at a suburban house, to look at a garage, to look at the closed shuttered door of a some sort of bunker-like building. That's what it was like. And there was something about the humor of that that appealed to me. It was like if you can imagine going back to biblical times and visiting the sites that Jesus had lived in, the people would look at you like you were crazy. You'd be looking at all these huts and shacks and little McBills, and they'd say, what are you doing here? In Europe, you usually build a giant statue over the top so you know something significant happened. It was really fun to visit something that is such recent history that there isn't a monument yet. There isn't something that makes it hallowed ground.
Right.
It's a place that only means something if you know about it. And that,
again,
is special. The idea that the things we do day by day, the places where we are, they're only special if we think they are. They're only special if they matter to us. And it's happy, but I like that as a thought.
No, that's a great thought. And I'm assuming you went to Aberdeen,
I did go out to Aberdeen, which was certainly an experience.
That place is
interesting
a total
watching that
shithole.
Place change.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was amazing. As you drive in, and they've got the Come As You Are sign, and they've got, you know, they donated the Kurt Cobain, you know, memorial to the local Star Wars shop, and, you know, they've got all this cheesy bullshit in tribute to him in a place that he hated, that never understood him in the first place, and it's a total, you know, redneck logging community. I just thought it was really interesting.
When I drove in, I went with a guy called Mitch, who was a friend of Kurt's, and knew Kurt's grandfather, and we did things, you know, I met Kurt Cobain's, one of Kurt Cobain's only remaining uncles. Went to his grandfather's graveside, things like that. And Mitch gave me that impression that for a long time, Aberdeen was so, so uncomfortable with the fact that this was their big icon. They didn't want to be associated with someone who spent his time telling everyone how awful the place was, and who was, to them, this kind of drug-taking, suicide, therefore godless guy. It's kind of lovely that the generations are changing, that there are people there now trying to make something of it, and there's a lot more openness to just letting them do it. You're right, it's always going to be weird. I think when things stop being uncomfortable, it means they've become safe. So when things like Cobain's journals came out, there was all the controversy around, should we ever be reading this? Is this too much? The film has just come out. Should we really be looking at some of this? And in a way, I don't know if there's a right answer to that. I think you just approach with some empathy and some respect.
Yeah.
But I think it's good that there is that discomfort. It means it still feels like something. And I think that matters.
It does. And it's interesting. I'm wondering, in your interview process, did you come across people that had the attitude, they were like, you know what, I've talked about Nirvana and Kurt Cobain enough. I don't want to talk about this anymore. Did you come across anyone like that?
Yeah, I came across quite a range of reactions. And Chad Channing, who's Nirvana's third drummer, I guess, fourth drummer, maybe, he's had enough of talking about it. That's fair enough. I can understand that. I never even approached Dave and Chris, partly because I thought that they have told the tale so many times over. I didn't see anything to gain. It wasn't the mission I was on.
Right.
But also because I imagine they must be bored by now, people asking about something that happened when they were so young. So I left that. There was Dave Foster, who was Nirvana's third drummer, who he's very, very uncomfortable speaking to journalists or writers because he feels he's been so poorly treated that, as far as he's concerned, he was just this young 19-year-old guy doing something he enjoyed and getting drunk and whatever else. And yet somewhere in a biography, it says that he was this drunk who got arrested for beating up the mayor's son and so on and so forth. And he feels so hurt that that's all that's ever mentioned about his time there, that he's just been forgotten. So he wouldn't interview, but he was so cooperative. He's seen the chapter I wrote about him, and he looked through and he made suggestions and comments, and in the end, he was willing to just put his name on the front in a quote just saying that I hadn't been a complete tool and that I hadn't been unfair to him. And that, little respect. That was great. And then there's someone like Aaron Burkhardt, the Van Halen drummer, who is so comfortable speaking about his time in that band. He's totally happy to do it. He's completely at peace with that period of his life.
Right. That's very interesting. I mean, there's, you know, like, I'm really looking forward to watching the montage of Heck, of course. But I always have these moments anytime I watch any sort of Nirvana documentary or read some, you know, fucking Rolling Stone article or something where I feel like people are like you know, hagiographies and things where they try and treat an individual or a band as something almost that wasn't real, you know, like a mythological creature or something. And so I have trepidation in just the way I view those things, because the way I see it, you know, Nirvana, who happens to be my all-time favorite band as a teen and an adult, you know, they're regular people that just happen to waltz into this incredible situation with their music. I mean, Kurt Cobain was a very flawed, insecure person, you know. He was just some pipsqueak guy that got massively famous, and but people treat him as if he's some sort of demigod or something. You know what I mean?
It's tricky to separate these things. It sounds like you've had the same journey where at some point you become an adult and you can separate the respect for someone's work and your enjoyment and love of what they do from just having to pretend that they're perfect. Cobain, as you say, he's really not perfect.
No.
He's a really troubled guy. I don't see any alternative to that, but that wasn't all he was either. And that's a nice thing to try and get back to. I mean, as I said, there's so many articles, there's so many books that all the time whilst I was writing this, I was writing it because it was a pleasure for me. It was something I wanted to do for fun. I was going to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I always had that question. Am I doing the right thing? Is this worth it at all? Is this something that does anything different to what's been done with this story? And that mattered. I didn't want to write, as a fan, I didn't want to write anything that I would have yawned at. And I hope if it served any purpose, if it did bring it back towards this idea that it wasn't just the superstars and everyone else.
Right.
If it just does that, I think that's what I was aiming for, to just make it a little more human, to make Nirvana almost blend into the background a little more, to show that they're part of this much wider picture.
Right.
And that's what I was trying to capture. There's enough books that'll tell you what's going on in Kurt Cobain's head. I was curious, what does it look like if you're the guy stood in the wings, having just come off stage, watching this next guy get up and play? Now, that was interesting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually curious, being a guy that used to collect bootlegs, and bootlegs were a thing, and I'm sure you were the same way. Do you have a favorite bootleg, whether it's a show in general or a version of a show?
There's two bootlegs, really, that were the heart of things for me. I think there was that moment in the late 90s where I think we all felt that the archive of unheard Cobain material, unheard Nirvana songs, was vast.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was bootlegs always using the wrong names for things. But the Ancestor Site series totally did it for me, because, there was one point where I think I had 50 versions of Smells Like Teen Spirit on the shelf. But hearing those real rarities, the songs that hadn't come out, that did it for me. So Ancestor Site 1 through 5, just every time those guys put out a record, you know it was going to be worth listening to. So this was a bootleg where someone somewhere was such a big fan that they really, really knew what they were picking out and putting in front of people.
Right.
The last time it happened to me is there's a bootleg out there called The Chosen Rejects from about 2010. It's four discs. It's probably the best late era bootleg, probably, you know, the last gasp of the bootleg era. Four discs of higher quality versions of stuff that's never come out, of stuff that hasn't been released officially. A real roundup of everything that's left, and that was the last time bootleg really sparked me in such a way. Awesome bit of work.
Right. I think my favorite's just from a live perspective and the sound quality. I really love how weird and how crisp the Buenos Aires show is from October of 92. just because it's a slick recording and it's a strange show, and that version of Beeswax is arguably my favorite live Nirvana cut of any bootleg. And then I've always been a big fan of Play the Fucking Guitar Man, just because it's such a great soundboard from a really wonderful era of the, you know, the Bleachers. Those are probably my two favorites, I think, just from a live perspective. Although the Paramount Theater is way up there. I mean, there's a lot of great ones, you know what I mean?
That Buenos Aires show is, it's one of those concerts that I come back to again and again and again, because I think it's absolutely so important. And to now be able to hear the audio, to hear how it went down,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does add a lot to it. For the book, I spoke to bands in Argentina and Brazil, and it was kind of nice. They were also pleased that someone from the West would bother to talk to them. They just said, well, you know, no one's ever spoken to us, no one's ever cared, apart from
right.
the local media, that we
right.
were ever here.
Right.
And their view on the Argentina show is so different. The traditional story that's told over and over again is that Calamity Jane are the little punk band who get up on stage and are treated with a sort of appalling sexism by
mm-hmm.
the Argentine fans. Well, the difficulty with that is that it's true, and that totally is what happens to them. It's awful.
Mm-hmm.
But the local band, and I'm just going to look up their name. Sorry about this. I'm just going to pull up this one.
Oh, no, it's okay.
Oh, there they are, yeah. It's a band called Los Brujos.
Okay.
And the funny thing is, Los Brujos in Argentina at the time, they are a gold record-selling band. They've had two massive hit albums. So Nirvana have only sold a gold record in Argentina at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Los Brujos are a band that, for local audiences, are on exactly the same level as Nirvana. So if you can imagine a concert where the first band on stage are Nirvana, then there's a local bar band who have never been on a stage this big and have never played in front of 50,000 people, have never
right.
even been to a festival. And then the next band on are Pearl Jam.
Right.
That's the kind of sense of it, that for a local crowd, this was a really weird gig. A lot of them had come to see Los Brujos. They watched them. They get hyped up from that because they're quite an interesting band in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly there's this kind of totally unknown band in the middle. They haven't got any music that anyone is going to have heard. They're, you know, a million miles away from them on the stage. And it's a very different vibe to play that kind of show compared to a club. So
right.
it's a shame how it went down. But there are reasons why I can understand why an Argentine audience were frustrated, because they're ready to see the superstars.
Right.
Who on earth is this? That was intriguing to me, to realize that there were some mitigating factors, that it wasn't just a case of a reaction to them being women on stage.
Right.
It was a reaction
yeah.
to seeing a complete unknown sandwiched
yeah.
between two really big bands.
Right.
What Nirvana do is brilliant. I mean, Nirvana play a set where the local crowds know less than half of the songs that are played.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, we're lucky. We're in the mainstream of the record industry's distribution network. So we have got Bleach at the time. We've got various bootlegs going around. There's stuff that's been on radio. There's the singles.
Right.
The only thing that's out in Argentina is Nevermind.
Right.
Everything else is complete mystery to them, which must be a really weird gig to go to. It sounds fun. I mean, I'd love to go to a gig and think, wow, I love Nirvana, and they're playing all these things that are rare and unknown. This is wonderful.
Yeah, I know.
For a local gig go in 92, it must have been really confusing.
Yeah. That's a good, that's a great story. That's one of my favorites for sure. And, yeah, I mean, this is fun for me. Like, you know, I just don't get to talk, you know, hardcore Nirvana stuff with people that I think get it very often. And yeah, it's really, really been a treat talking to you for the last 45 minutes or so.
I hope the book will just feel right to you, that it respects not just Nirvana, but the people who are in it, who my view on them is that people like you and I who followed a passion at some point, and that felt pretty precious to me. Now, the final couple of pages, instead of dwelling on, you know, the death of Cobain, I deliberately tried to list out all the other musicians who were friends of the people who I interviewed, who were band members or played alongside Nirvana in this book, and who died. There's a guy from one band who ends up in Nicaragua on some sort of trip and gets robbed for his laptop and shot in the head. There's two members of the band who apparently are there when Courtney and Kurt first meet in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
The band who played that night. There's two members of that, the three members up, and two of them ended up dead of drug overdoses. Another guy dies of a brain hemorrhage. In a small community like this, there's always going to be death, and some of them are going to be awful. It's just, it's really strange, really unusual when it's the superstar, it's the one who goes. Normally there's kind of a network, and there's a nice cushion of money to stop those people falling out.
Right.
It's unusual when those people go at the peak of their moment.
Yeah.
For a band that's been around 7 years, he's only famous for 2 years of it. It's really strange to think that by the time Nirvana get famous, by the time the likes of, by the time the likes of I hear of them, they're barely playing anymore, they're barely recording, there's barely any more music. He's barely talking to the media. Anything that is part of the life of a band has almost stopped.
Right.
From the moment they become famous. And that's really intriguing. It doesn't
mean
it wouldn't have come back. But it's amazing that that moment of fame is when they are least together and there's the least going on. It's quite a curious thought.
It's a very, very interesting story all the way through. And I thank you again, Nick. And
I hope it brings some listeners your way as well. So, it's nice to keep the good vibes feedback going around.
Exactly. All right, Nick. Let's have a good rest
it's
of your
good
evening.
Nirvana knowledge, fella. It's excellent talking to someone who knows about Nirvana. It's brilliant. You end up not answering the same questions. Again, it's superb to answer questions about stuff that, has that little bit of extra. Someone who really knows their bootlegs and so on is brilliant.
That's great. That's great to hear, man. All right. Okay.
Nice. If you come over, I will totally give you a book. I'll totally sign the thing, whatever. Just if you make it over here, genuinely, just holler.
Absolutely. All right, Nick. Have a good evening.
You too, man.